Hey y'all, it's Lauren. Throughout this season, it has been our mission to bring you stories about the environment in which we live in, to tell the stories of those living in unhealthy environments and how those environments came to be, and what we can do now to create a better environment for the future. But in order to complete this series on the environment, we had to discuss land, the people who originated from that land, and the movements to restore and give back to Indigenous people. Native Women's Care Circle, a prayer group that promotes the health and welfare of the Native American community in the St. Louis area, invited me into a sacred space where the group comes together to discuss their lives.
This is our Monday morning MOURING meeting. And we started this group when we've had people that were needing self-care from grieving and from all the trials of the pandemic. So Native Women's Care Circle, some of us are on here, some have to meet in the evenings because they work, and people come and go as they need to.
That's Sandy, a member of Native Women's Care Circle, and she opened up the floor for other attendees to introduce themselves and talk about their work, like Darshan.
My lineage is mostly Indigenous and African on my father's line, and my mother's line is Ashkenazi Jewish. I've been a part of Native Women's Care Circle for about 3 years. It's directly connected to land back, including the dismantling of statues. On the island here, I'm working right now for a Black and Indigenous Land Trust. I'm also part of wider networks, building immersive curriculum on decolonization and embodied healing. In addition to working with people, I really like to work with our Indigenous roots and seeds. So food justice to me is around seed sovereignty and food sovereignty, which is deeply connected to the land back movement.
And Wendy.
I was born and raised on the Standing Rock Reservation. I moved to Missouri in 2005. I've been here since. Land back is something that is a thin line to walk, especially with our people in regards to the Black Hills. That was our sacred ceremonial area where we would go yearly and do prayers. And once gold was found, it got stolen from us. And they still want us to take the money, but none of our tribes want to because it's not about the money. It's about the location and what we did there. It's a very sacred area for us. So to this day, we are fighting the government in regards to the Black Hills. We want our Black Hills back, but obviously they've developed them so much that how would we get our land back? They can't destroy all those houses. They've commercialized it. So we just want the land back in regards to that. The Trail of Tears, 1830s, the Indian Removal Act, I believe, was established. And that's when they moved the Eastern Indians on the Trail of Tears here to the western part or to Oklahoma. They took their land away and put them in an area where they had no clue how to live or survive. But as Indigenous people, they survived. They made it work. So this land back is a very delicate issue for a lot of Native Americans. They see anger right away. They get upset about it because our way of telling our history is not written down on books. It's starting to, but the way we were taught and our ancestors did, we orally told our traditions. So a lot of it's not written down. Like I said, until recently, it's starting to. So a lot of this is new to a lot of people. They're writing things down. They're starting to learn about our culture and our ways. And it is a good thing. And it is also could be a bad thing.
Then Janet discussed how Native Women's Care Circle has supported her on her journey with identity.
I know that culturally in Native American groups, the stories and the ways were passed down, like somebody said earlier, through communication, talking, and that's how they kept their history alive and rich and their ways kind of passed down to the next generations. but my family is completely disconnected from that side of our heritage. So although I know I have Cherokee blood, I don't know anything about the traditions or the wisdom that my elders would have given me had I been raised in that space. To be in the space where I get to learn from Fondi and hopefully Sherry, there's missing pieces of my puzzle that I definitely know from my time with Sandy. I'm learning things and understanding more things about why I am the way I am from being around them. And so that has been such a huge blessing and a breakthrough. And that's why I keep coming back.
Being able to learn from elders and build upon your heritage is important. But here in St. Louis, there is no Indian Center, and they are often invisible in their own community.
And I know some of us have experienced lots of different ways that we are chastised, that we are stopped. I've seen women walking in prayer for the water, and we have to worry about the police. We have a thing called the longest walk. And that's when the Navajo, the Diné, were also forced to move. And some of those people from the Black Mesa Coalition, Hopi and Navajo Diné people, came to St. Louis to fight against Peabody mining because they had decimated their water table. So they're up here trying to get reparations. These are people that can't even use the water on their land for their plants. They can't brush their teeth with it, bathe in it, nothing. If there's water there, it's that polluted. They have to truck in water for their households, for their farming, for everything.
Not having the resources and support for families and groups coming through our region is why a lot of groups like Native Women's Care Circle have stepped up to the plate. But what caused this invisibility? And how can we work to identify and provide more resources and spaces for Indigenous people to thrive? So in this episode, we hear from a PhD student working on a project to combat Indigenous people's invisibility in our region, and a director providing a space for students to learn about American Indian history and culture. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here. We wanted to learn more about how Native researchers are combating the invisibility of Native people in Missouri, which is why we spoke to Lindsay Manshack, a member of the Choctaw Apache tribe of Ebarb and a first-year PhD student at the University of North Dakota studying Indigenous health.
My ancestral land of my tribal people is located in Louisiana, which is where I was born. We moved to Missouri whenever I was 6 years old. Growing up in Missouri is definitely different being away from my tribe and just that culture of Indigenous culture. And one thing that I found ever since I was very young living in Missouri is that Indigenous traditional culture is hard to find in Missouri, although there are many Native people here. You know, we're not represented in public spaces or spaces very often in this state. And so finding that cultural identity, reconnecting with that cultural identity, and using my cultural identity as a protective factor for mental health, physical health, all those things just isn't possible as a young Native person in Missouri.
The experiences Lindsay had growing up in Missouri stem from the history of Native people being removed and displaced over time.
The ancestral land of Missouri, most well known as the Osage Nation, who were here ancestrally, but there were many, many other Indigenous groups here as well. And so they're just the most well known. And they have the treaty with the Young American Republic that was signed in 1808 saying, sign this treaty or face annihilation. And so Indigenous people were removed from Missouri in 1808. And then 1956 is when we saw Indigenous people come back to Missouri through the Urban Indian Relocation Program, which brought people to St. Louis. And so we have a very diverse amount of Indigenous people. There's over 265 federally recognized tribes. So we have a lot of people who came back in 1956 because of that Indian Act. And since then, you know, there wasn't a lot of funding that continued any of that Indigenous culture, and those promises that were made kind of have disappeared, and we don't hear about them. We don't have an American Indian Center here. We don't have anything like that. And so it's the community's job to band together.
There are over 80,000 Native people living in the state of Missouri, but Missouri is one of 13 states without any state or federally recognized tribes.
Not having that federal recognition or having a tribal nation in the state greatly impacts the policies that come with public health data surveillance, come with other public health and health insurance programs that the state offers. And that voice, usually which comes with tribal sovereignty and exercising some of that tribal sovereignty, isn't there, because all we have is groups of people who care deeply about their Indigenous culture, but we don't have the same unique rights as a tribe does in a state that has that. So having like an MOU with the institutions or with the state is really difficult to have if you don't have these community advisory boards established and treated with respect. It just makes it a little bit difficult if you don't have those state or federally recognized tribes.
This is why Lindsay is working on a grant-funded research project to combat the invisibility of Native people in Missouri and break down the disparities in cancer mortality.
At my time working at Washington University School of Medicine, we saw that there was a need for cancer research among this community here in Missouri. Not only a need through the statistics, but directly from the community telling us we want to know more about what's happening at this level of cancer incidence and cancer prevalence among our community, because we feel like it's an important enough topic that we really want to get involved in that. And so through that knowledge with the community, and then through separately my fellowship, there was an opportunity to apply for a grant focusing on American Indian cancer. And so I used those two to bring them together and create a grant, a research study that met the community's needs. And that is a cancer research study where we're gathering qualitative data from cancer survivors here in Missouri and analyzing that data to look for similarities, you know, qualitative or rigorous and methodical approach to actually providing us with some data, which hasn't really been done before.
And it was extremely important for her to have community input and involvement. So she put together a community advisory board.
We have elders and tribal members from across the state. And I asked them if they would want to serve in this capacity. And it's a common practice now among Indigenous researchers. They know that this shouldn't benefit us in our careers only. The research that we do, we have such intimate connection with our community that we have to ask permission for everything we do. We want to ask permission. We want to do no harm to our community. And so a community advisory board such as this allows us to ask the community what they want. You know, we can mock up some of the interview questions or the survey questions, but then they can review them and say, yes, we like this. No, we don't. You know, we want to add some questions about COVID in here. We want to add this question. And it's allowing them to ask the questions that are going to be most useful, the answers to the questions are going to be most useful for them in whatever capacity they need on the tables that they're sitting at, because many of the tribal members in the urban setting are sitting at university level tables, institutional levels, you know, and even state level tables, but they don't have that data to bring forth. They just have, you know, mostly anecdotal information about their community. And this isn't the same for all states, because Missouri is a pretty unique state whenever it comes to Indigenous culture.
Lindsay explains that the invisibility and lack of data on Indigenous health is deadly.
There is data genocide happening, and a lot of times in these urban settings, meaning that Native people are going into the healthcare system. The nurses or the health professionals may not be equipped to ask about racial data. And I think that that's what we're seeing here in Missouri. And so we're seeing Native people come into the healthcare system, but as they get chronic illnesses or go through the healthcare system, that data that's then given to the state and then given to the federal government is skewed because that racial data is inaccurate and oftentimes misclassified. And we've seen this throughout the country with the Indian Health Service and tumor registries. So whenever there have been linkage projects in the past comparing cancer rates that were collected in the state's tumor registry versus the Indian Health Service, there was a huge percentage of inaccuracies. And so if we're seeing that in states that have Indian Health Service facilities, which Missouri does not, I would imagine we're seeing an even larger percentage of misclassification in our state. And that's what our elders and our community members also think is happening as well. And some of the research that I'm doing is to try to figure out what is the misclassification rate in Missouri and how can we make it more accurate.
Making the data more accurate and accessible is important because without the research and knowledge of Indigenous people, policies won't support Indigenous public health.
So there was a study done by a group called Illuma Native who did this research. They surveyed policymakers, politicians, and they asked, do you think that invisibility of Indigenous people will affect policy? And they did find statistically significant answers that yes, it does greatly influence a policymaker's invisibility of Indigenous people influences a policymaker's decisions, what bills are put up. If they don't think Native people are there, they're not going to be advocating for on their behalf for healthcare.
This is why the overall goal for the project is to create a centralized place for Indigenous data.
So we're creating a website that's going to be specifically for Native American health, focus on Missouri. We're going to have population census data. Even census data isn't easy to access about Indigenous people in Missouri. And so we've analyzed, you know, the census data for the last, you know, decades. And that's on there. It's going to be in a report that's easily downloadable for Indigenous people in Missouri. And it's for anyone who wants to look at it. Specifically, it's designed, the audience will be Indigenous people who live in Missouri, the 80,000 people. But it's also going to be able to, you know, policymakers, directors of healthcare systems, you know, nonprofits such as the American Cancer Society, they're going to be able to go and download this data as well and say, oh, there's a whole population here that we just kind of overlooked. And so it will have a lot of that data. It also have resources specific to Indigenous people. So one thing we kind of touched on is federally recognized tribes and state recognized tribes. State recognized tribes don't get Indian Health Service access. Like they don't get the Indian Health Service. So they're not able to go to Indian Health Service and get healthcare, whereas federally recognized tribal members are. But in Missouri, we don't have a single Indian Health Service facility, but we have many people from federally recognized tribes. And so in the website, we're going to have resources that our community has been using to get healthcare and tips on, you know, if you're experiencing cancer or have just gotten a cancer diagnosis, connecting them with the cancer navigators that we have and that are funded pretty much on their own volunteer basis in the hopes that these efforts and this stuff will be on record now so that we can apply for grants or, you know, the state can have a specific program for American Indians that is a starting place for Indigenous people to be in charge of that program and create data linkages or just create these reports. And it's really important that the Native people here in Missouri are in charge of their own data and that it's being used in the way that they want, because historically that data has been used as a deficit perspective to look at Indigenous people.
But compiling the data and creating an accessible website is just one step toward creating a healthier environment for Indigenous people. And there are still a host of other environmental factors that put Indigenous people at a disadvantage.
Indigenous people across the globe are disproportionately affected by climate change because they will be one of the first in line of dealing with the consequences of climate change. So we have rising sea levels along the coast, which is where many Indigenous people live. So fishing over those areas is going to become harder and harder. We're already seeing that. We have oil pipelines in areas where many Indigenous tribes and reservations live. For my tribe, located in Louisiana, we're right by the Gulf of Mexico. So any oil pipelines, which there's hundreds that connect throughout North America to that Gulf of Mexico, any spills are going to come down through the land and through the waterways and directly into the tribes located in Louisiana. And so we're already seeing that Indigenous people living in close proximity to some of those locations have higher rates of cancers, and specifically higher rates of rare forms of cancer. And so if they're experiencing higher rates of cancer, of rare forms of cancer, which are hard to treat as well, then they're coming into the same healthcare system as a non-Indigenous person, but probably at a later stage if they don't have health insurance or access to Indian health service facilities. And that's leading to higher rates of cancer. And I believe that goes back to some of my research here in Missouri. That's why we're doing some of this research work, is because we clearly see this perspective in this phenomenon that's going on. Especially as an Indigenous person, we're taught to look through a two-eyed seeing approach, which is using and looking at Western methods, but also understanding the world from an Indigenous point of view. It's a very holistic point of view, a very systems thinking point of view.
Native people value their connection to Mother Earth, and bringing back Native traditions is one way of continuing a legacy for the next generation.
What we see plainly is that land is all-encompassing of every part of Mother Earth's system. So from the waterways to the skies, the way that Indigenous people view land is all of it. And we need to care for Earth because it is also a form of medicine for humans. And so there's this inherent idea of one health. There's a movement where we look at how the Earth interacts with humans and interacts with animals. And so caring for the land is a responsibility that many Indigenous people feel. And part of that is because of our Indigenous traditional ecological knowledge, which refers to the evolving knowledge acquired by Indigenous people over hundreds of thousands of years. And there's one story that I'll share about Grandmother Agnes, who brought back a ceremony called the Sacred Ceremony. And she brings in youth to learn about this sacred ceremony and the life cycle of the salmon to help people understand and honor how Indigenous health and human health is influenced by environmental health. And so she shares how the female salmon makes a long journey upstream to her place of origin, where she lays her eggs for the first time. And then she turns back downstream. During this slow death, her flesh falls off into the water and it nurtures little fish. The remains of her body nourishes 33 kinds of birds and 44 kinds of animals who drink from the river and carry her minerals to replenish the land. And so this is an example of traditional ecological knowledge. So Indigenous ceremonies, bringing those back and bringing forth Indigenous culture, can teach new generations about how to keep Mother Earth happy, humans happy, and healthy together. I have a younger brother who's 9 years old. I see him experiencing the same things I experienced over 20 years ago in Missouri. My work is dedicated specifically to the experiences that my family has experienced in Missouri. I think I would hope that other Missourians would start seeing a more accurate and authentic portrayal of Native people, Native American people in Missouri, a recognition that they're here, and a respect for their history of being removed, coming back here, not having resources, and really the community is leaving every health of it that we have. So our elders are working very, very hard. So I hope in the future, the work that I'm doing alongside the community, they'll be at the next step of that. They'll be at the tables talking to the policymakers. There'll be programs already funded so that they don't have to do this work that's really just at the very beginning stages, even starting a conversation about how many Native people are here. I hope that that becomes really obvious for kids and for adults to say, oh yeah, there's over 80,000 in Missouri. That would be amazing. I would love that. And it is starting to happen. I do some presentations throughout the state for the Missouri Humanities Council, and that statistic, I'm starting to hear it, not from my own mouth. I'm starting to hear it from other people, like, oh, I heard there's 80,000 American Indians, and that just brightens my day. And so I think that the awareness of Indigenous people are here is the first step.
Lindsay hopes that her research project will help support Indigenous people through data collection and plans to keep seeking community support to ensure that Indigenous people are represented at every step, from project to policy. So up next, we hear from the director of the Catherine M. Booter Center for American Indian Studies about how to combat the invisibility of Indigenous people in Missouri by decolonizing social work education and preparing future American Indian leaders. The Catherine M. Booter Center for American Indian Studies is located in the Brown School of Social Work at Washington University in St. Louis. It aims to prepare future American Indian leaders to practice in tribal and urban settings and make significant contributions to the health, wellness, and the sustained future of Indian country. Kelly Thompson, the director for the Booter Center, has been in St. Louis for about 13 years and says there is a lot more to learn about Indigenous history and culture in St. Louis.
As someone who didn't grow up here, really, I am still learning all of this myself. But what I think is really powerful and important to think about is the history, really, because, and I don't just mean pre-colonial history, but also the history, more recent history, because there were Indigenous people in St. Louis. I would love that to be shared in all levels of a person's education, not only in St. Louis, but across the country, right? And all the way through to where we are now, because there is so much to learn and to help us move forward as we think about, in my world, supporting students, right? Indigenous students through this program, but also as we're coming together with the community, not just Native people, but all of our communities, as we're thinking about equity and racial justice and all of these things that we work and learn about within social work. I think it's very relevant, the history and how we got to where we are and where we can go from here.
Indigenous people have a sacred connection to the land, which is why social work practice in tribal settings should be grounded in connections between the people, the land, and water.
That's a very important worldview that Native people hold. And it's very intuitive to bring those things to our practice and talk about those things with each other. And really, that's a strength because the land, our culture, even our language, a lot of these things that we hold close to ourselves and with our people, that can be used as a strength when we're thinking about working with Indigenous clients and Indigenous peoples. And so we're thinking about how we're working with Native clients, or, you know, how the students will work with Native clients and how to decolonize this process at the same time. How is that connection to the land? How can we use that to help you through whatever you're going through right now? Because it is such a strength. And culture helps people get through hard times. Because there's 574 tribes, federally recognized tribes. It's so diverse. We may be speaking with a client who's Native, but maybe a completely different tribe than your own. And so it's learning how to not maybe have all of the answers, right? Or not be that medicine person. Perhaps you're not, or you're not granted that. Know when to ask those questions and who to go to in the community to help this person if they want that.
But decolonizing social work can be challenging.
It's hard to think about decolonizing systems when we're working within those systems. So it's kind of about stepping outside of some of these traditional ways of thinking and bringing those Indigenous values and Indigenous cultures and worldviews, those things that really make up us as Indigenous people or the student as a Native person, like bring that and see how we can, right now, we're in the point where we need to think about how we can work within that system. But really our goal is to work and create a new system that can bring about greater change.
And recently, Kelly authored an article about Indigenous worldviews and social work field practice, where she recommends that students learn about Indigenous human rights issues to help support their practice.
In our classes across the country, not just at the Brown School, there are Indigenous students, right, who are wanting to learn this, who may know a lot of this or have practiced some of these things in the field. But there are also some students who may not know what some of these issues are, but who likely will have a Native client, right? An Indigenous client or work within an Indigenous community. And while they're in the Brown School or wherever, in whatever educational setting that they're in, it's so important to give those students information about the history, right? When we talk about those things, it's kind of like we have to start first with sharing general information, because it's often Indigenous people may seem like the invisible in a lot of ways, and we're missing from data sets, and stories are told not by us often, but by others about us. Having that first step in just learning about the population is so important. And then in these classes, understanding how social workers can impact, whether it's their clients or it's a community or it's a policy, right? Like if they're working in government, how those decisions impact Indigenous people is so important, because we know that sometimes those conversations haven't happened and we don't know what we don't know, right? And so if we can ensure that these students get the knowledge and then have opportunities to practice and work within these communities, it's so important in the learning process.
She adds that Indigenous knowledge has also been threatened by the COVID-19 pandemic, which has disproportionately impacted communities of color across the country.
For Native people, it has highlighted huge gaps in healthcare access, access to clean water, but also healthcare issues too, and disparity. So it's highlighted some of those things, but it's also widened the gap. And so when we're thinking about some of these things, we know that these disparities existed before COVID. And I think it has helped us highlight those in a more public way because of it. But what I'm hoping that it also does is that we don't forget that these disparities and gaps exist. And now they're widened because of the pandemic. Not only the public health piece of these things, but even social justice aspects as well. I mean, we're losing elders. These elders are wisdom keepers in our language. Like, we're losing languages because some tribes have, you know, a dozen people can speak the language and they're elders and they're lost because of COVID. And so knowing that language is helpful and, you know, dealing with mental health crises or culture is helpful in these things, we're losing those elders who can shape our future mental health care system. But of course, the pandemic highlights so many disparities within our communities.
Even as disparities persist, Kelly remains inspired by the efforts of Buddha Center alum to advocate for Indigenous people in policy and practice.
We have students who've graduated and gone on to do amazing, amazing things, not just since I've been back as the director, but even before that. Our alum go on to get their PhDs and teach within university settings. They go on to lead national Native organizations. We have alum who go back to their communities and sometimes are the only social worker in the reservation community. And hearing that, you know, it's a responsibility, but it's a good responsibility, because that community wouldn't have had that without that person going back and serving their people. So that's so nice to hear. We have students who do their practicums at different Native organizations. And I always like to hear when a student gets offered a position at that site because they've done such a great job. And I've heard that many times in the last few years. And so that's really wonderful to hear. I would like to see Native communities thrive. I think that in the work that I do, the way that I can help see that happen is to help our students at the school through this program and provide them what they need to succeed within the Brown School, but also to succeed when they graduate and step into those positions or leadership roles. I think that I always try to leave something better than when I found it or when I came here. Personally, I try to do that. And so what I shared is one way I think that I can try to make that happen.
This show is produced by me, Lauren Brown, and lead producer Jolianne Yang. One more note before we go. St. Louis Public Radio is looking into racially restrictive covenants and deeds in the St. Louis region. In the early to mid-1900s, white homeowners and realtors commonly used these tools to keep black people out of certain neighborhoods. If you live in an old home, check your records. They might have clues that could inform our reporting. Look through your real estate documents for restrictions on who can own it and live there. You can find more information on how to share those documents and your stories with us on our website at stlpr.org/housingdiscrimination. St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri St. Louis. From St. Louis Public Radio and PRX, this is We Live Here.
Support for this podcast comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.